Hi, this is Steve Roost, and you're listening to Health Tech Hour on UK Health Radio. Each week, we give you the best news, views, and interviews from the health technology world. From CEOs and founders to entrepreneurs and clinicians, the companies and people that are shaping the future face of healthcare. All on the world's number one talk health radio. Hello and welcome to this week's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost. Each week we bring you the best news, views and interviews with the leaders, clinicians, CEOs and founders that are changing the face of healthcare in the UK and beyond. As regular listeners know, I am the CEO and founder of a business called PocDoc. PocDoc's Healthy Heart Check is now the number one diagnostic product on the high street. It gives you the equivalent of an NHS health check in just 9 minutes. You can do it at home on your sofa. So head to Boots, Superdrug, any of the high street names, online or in store, and you can get your Healthy Heart Check. If you would like any more information, please head to pocdoc.co. That's pocdoc.co. Thank you to everyone that's listening live on UK Health Radio. We really love being on UK Health Radio. We love Johan and his amazing team and the live platform that this brings us. There's tons of other great presenters doing great shows, so make sure that you check them all out. Thanks to everyone who's listening on demand on the podcast channels, your podcast channel of choice. We are on all of them, the show's on all of them. And thank you if you're watching either on YouTube or on my Instagram channel, which is Steve Roost. So thank you very much for being here. We wouldn't be here without you. Audience keeps growing and we love that. So we must be doing something right. Now, on to today's show. Now, this is a really interesting area. And I saw or came across the guest on today's show. I think it was on social media. It was either on Instagram or on LinkedIn. And I think it might have been actually through my co-founder, my wife, who had mentioned that she'd seen some of the stuff that they were doing and got me interested. So it's in this whole area of addiction therapy and trying to use digital technology to assuage, prevent, treat addiction, particularly focused on alcohol, but presumably other substances also come into play. And it was the first business that I had seen in this space. Not that I did a lot of research, but a lot of prior to this, but a lot of it was a clinician-led business, an expert-led business in the space, but that was completely digital. Obviously, addiction therapy, for anyone, you know, obviously listening that's been through it or sort of been around it, is generally, I would argue, considered to be a face-to-face, high touch type of approach, very difficult to treat, lots of recidivism, if that's applicable to this space. And so I just was super interested to get this person on to talk about his business and how digital technology is being applied in the addiction space. So my guest today is Dr. David McLaughlin, who is the CEO and founder of Curb Health. David, welcome to the show. How are you?
Hi there, Steve. Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much for having me. Yeah, big fan of this show. So it's a huge honor for me to come on, and also big fans of everything that yourself and your wife have achieved with PocDoc. I really enjoy just seeing all the success and the milestones that you guys are achieving. So it's inspiring for other founders like myself to see the path that you're paving and hopefully kind of following it, I guess, in some extent.
Thank you. Well, that's really, I really appreciate you saying that. And similarly, I've really enjoyed, as a research the show, learning more about Curb on social. And it seems like you've managed to create a really strong community around this already from a really early start. That was going to be something that I wanted to talk about, but we can jump right into that now if you want to. But as well as, like, I'd love to understand your journey to this point.
Yeah, sure. I mean, definitely the community element is hugely important, and I can definitely talk about that. In terms of my journey to this point, I'd be lying if I said it was easy. I think most health tech founders can probably relate to the fact that building a business and building things which are innovative and disruptive isn't always easy. But it's that challenge which gets me excited. It gets me out, bouncing out of bed in the morning, just that kind of hunger to solve really important big problems that actually change people's lives.
And on that, how everyone's aware of, I mean, I say everyone, I'm guessing most people listening, if not all people listening, are familiar with the concept of addiction in general, I suspect. You know, the ongoing argument I have with my wife is whether or not I'm actually addicted to coffee, or whether one can even be addicted to coffee. But there's lots of things. But the concept of addiction, I guess we're familiar with. But to that point, what is the scale of addiction? Or is there any way to sort of quantify, because there's different types and different subtypes and things like that. Like how big a problem is addiction conceptually?
So this is the multi-billion dollar question, isn't it? Okay, so addiction as an illness is a continuum. So I actually sometimes talk about harmful habits and addictive behavior. Because if you think about alcohol, for example, there is the ICD-10 and DSM, these diagnostic manuals. The definition of alcohol addiction is quite strict, and that has six different criteria according to like tolerance, dependence, cravings, loss of control, continued use despite harm. But actually, there's all sorts of different harmful patterns of behavior with alcohol use, like binge drinking, even just intermittent kind of episodes where you just drink too much and you fall and you slip and you break a bone in your arm, you end up in A&E. So I sometimes talk about addiction as a continuum from kind of intermittent use, going through harmful use all the way through to kind of binge drinking and actually full on physiological dependence. The kind of people that might be drinking every single day, first thing in the morning, people that might need a medically assisted detox, people with liver cirrhosis and liver failure. But actually, if we think about alcohol addiction as a continuum, that's one way to think about it. But then the other thing is, of course, there's so many different substances and behaviors that you can be dependent on. And it's enormously difficult to put a price on the cost of addiction, because it costs society in so many different ways, and probably it's like a ripple effect starting, you know, if you imagine the person who has the harmful habit or addictive behavior, it ripples out from them and it affects, you know, their a family, it affects their employer, it affects the healthcare system, criminal justice system. There's so many interfaces where this cost and this burden is felt, starting with the person at the center and rippling all the way around. And that cost begins not when you've got liver cirrhosis, but it starts much, much earlier. Even from just kind of what some of us might consider social drinking, like when there's a hangover. I mean, in the UK economy, I can tell you that it costs the NHS around about £3 billion per year. Alcohol.
Hold up a minute. Let back the truck up a second. So we're a broad church on the show, so we like to make sure that we're all on the same page. So completely agree with you about this continuum idea. And I think that's a helpful way to think about it, because like there's a lot of stuff I guess you see in media or culture around you are either an alcoholic or you're not an alcoholic, right? It's like, well, and there's a lot of stuff around, well, I can't be an alcoholic because I'm not like that. You know, and I think this continuum concept makes a lot of sense. But you mentioned a couple of things in there. One was physiological dependence, which is at the very far, well, left or right, I can't tell which hand you're using. So that's on the one end. What do you mean by that? Just so we're all on the same page.
Okay, so with many addictive substances, when you use them frequently over a period of time, there's receptors in your body that adapt and change to the presence, in response to the presence of that substance. So for alcohol, those receptors are called GABA receptors, and they adapt because they become used to the presence of alcohol. And then when alcohol is removed from those receptors, you get a rebound effect, and those receptors are, the new normal for those receptors is the presence of alcohol. And so they become hyperactive in the absence of alcohol. So those, all of the neural pathways mediated by GABA receptors become hyperactive, and that's when you can have withdrawal, seizures, hallucinations, and a condition called delirium tremens.
The shakes,
essentially. Yeah, this is when you see people experiencing alcohol withdrawal and they're a bit shaky, that's because their GABA receptors have become habituated and used to the presence of alcohol. And then now when you take away the alcohol, those receptors are hyperactive, and then they get the shakes, and you start this whole pathway of alcohol withdrawal. And those are the kind of people that would need a medically assisted detox.
Right. So that's at the one end. And then let's go back to your point around the NHS spending £3 billion a year. How does that break down? That's an enormous amount of money.
It is a huge amount of money. And again, this has actually been one of the challenges that we found as a company, trying to attribute cost to alcohol, because alcohol affects virtually every organ in your body. So like I said, the liver clinics, but it's also responsible for causing 12 different types of cancer. So not just
only 12. I thought it was like contributory to so much more. Is that causing it? Causes 12, and the others, it just kind of makes your risk factors worse.
I mean, there's 12 that I know of. So like things like, I mean, the ones that are really predictable: pancreatic cancer, liver cancer, esophageal cancer, but even breast cancer. And so there was a horrifying paper that was published a couple of years ago showing that one bottle of wine, it has the same carcinogenic risk in breast cancer as 5 cigarettes. But it's really interesting.
Bloody hell. Well, sorry, I'm not allowed to swear on the show. I was about to swear.
Yeah.
That's astonishing.
Yeah, it's quite horrifying, isn't it? Because that's just not.
Yeah.
I don't think people realize that. I mean, alcohol is a class one carcinogen. It's in the same class as asbestos and radiation.
Whoa, hold up a second, wait there. Alcohol is in the same carcinogenic category as asbestos and radiation.
Yes, yeah, it's quite shocking, but of course.
Yeah, I mean, that's insane. I can't believe I never knew that. That's mm-hmm. that's mental.
Yeah, it's really horrifying. So breaking down which segments of the healthcare system, what the costs are related to alcohol, it's super a huge hard. Challenge. I mean, it's a huge, and also what degrees of alcohol misuse as well. But again, if I was an A&E doctor, we were in central London, and you were to ask me what proportion of A&E admissions, presentations at the weekends and evenings are related to alcohol misuse, I think it's probably around about at least 25%, if not more.
I mean,
so there's huge cost to the healthcare system. But the other, I mean, our initial market has been in employee well-being.
Interesting.
It was much easier for us to ascribe a cost to employers, because there's really clear, easy data on essentially how much alcohol was costing employers. And actually, if you go to our website, www.curb.health, we actually have a calculator for employers where they can play with this calculator. They just have to tell us how many employees they have, what's the size of their organization, and what's the average labor cost per employee. And then we can use statistics we've got from the Institute of Alcohol Studies and the Office of National Statistics, and we can give you a cost of hangovers every year, and what hangovers are costing your organization.
That's brilliant. Let's take we'll get into that in a second. Let's take a step back. So how did you come? Because again, a lot of what we've just talked about, and we were in the same boat, by the way, at PocTalk, which is the problems and costs and issues around cardiovascular disease are well known. So the issues around addiction are all well known, basically, right? I mean, apart from the fact that I didn't know that thing about the categorization of alcohol, but that aside, how did you, what approach did you take that you felt was new in building Curb? Or like, why did you build Curb to do what it does? What's that? How did that happen?
So I think, like a lot of entrepreneurs, I see problems that I want to fix, and it becomes irresistible and it becomes compulsive. And when you see that things are a bit broken, it's just in my nature to want to try and fix them. So I become I saw this problem that, you know, with the way in which we support people with addiction. And the issues that I saw were that there was enormous numbers of barriers getting people access to treatment and getting people access to care. And those barriers were things like stigma, shame, but also NHS waiting list times are enormously long. NHS addiction services are often perceived as only for those who are most severely dependent. So there's a lot of people who wouldn't consider themselves alcoholic, who are kind of holding down jobs. They might be bankers, lawyers, builders, you know, barristers.
Well, and also, like, I mean, you know, when you go to the GP and they ask you how much you drink, you know what I mean? Like, that's a very easy question to kind of lowball. You know,
exactly.
And presumably that's the front door of referral into those programs. And so if people are sort of lowballing that question, then that means that they're not going to have access to those programs.
They are definitely, that's an issue, because again, it's the stigma and shame. When you see a doctor face to face, or you're speaking to your insurance provider, there's that kind of stigma and shame. So people tend to lowball how much they're really drinking. And especially when they're quite highly functional, often, again, like many kind of physical or mental health issues, the real problems only really manifest when it's actually quite, when the disease or illness is already kind of, it's got its hooks into you. Because alcohol addiction, it creeps up on you, it's insidious. The other barriers, you know, as well as the obvious ones, like the wait list times, were the fact that if you go to private services, it's really expensive. So it might cost £20,000 to £30,000 for alcohol detox. So for many people, that is just totally unaffordable.
Yeah, completely.
The other thing that kind of frustrated me about the way that we treat people with addiction, apart from the stigma, the cost, the waiting list times, was the fact that we were still treating people in this really reactive way. When the proverbial has hit the fan, you know, when people have already kind of fallen over, tripped and broken a leg, or when they've already got liver cirrhosis, we're treating them in this reactive way when they've already been done for drink driving. And also we were seeing them in clinics in this very episodic way. And I just, one of the things that I'd seen in other, I've seen this emerging technology, and I'd seen it being applied to other conditions like depression, bipolar effect disorder, where really clever researchers at the Institute of Psychiatry, where I was doing a research fellowship at the time, they were using data from people's wearable devices, like Fitbits, Garmins, and also data from people's smartphones to try and predict when people were most vulnerable to relapse. And so I looked at all the studies in depression, and there was really strong evidence that you could predict depressive relapses. You know, when people's step count reduces, or when they're kind of going to less diverse
places. Kind of concept. Yeah.
All of those things we could predict when people were most vulnerable to relapse and depression. And I just thought, well, why aren't we doing this with addiction? Why aren't we trying to identify when people are most vulnerable to these harmful patterns of behavior, and then offering them an intervention, a just-in-time adaptive intervention? What could we do to make this a much more personalized experience for people, and removing the stigma, removing those barriers like cost, geography, stigma, shame, waiting list times? Why aren't we using this emerging technology to remove some of those barriers? And yeah, I couldn't help myself and just got stuck in.
Right. I want to pick up on moving into the bit of the show where we talk about how CURB works. I think that was a really good explanation, because obviously, I mean, we can talk about it in a second, but I love going through periods of time where I give up alcohol. And I think it's really been beneficial for me in a lot of different ways. And what I've come across, I've done all kinds of different things around trackers and drinks things. And so I want to understand how it very much differentiates itself from that. But we will be back in 2 minutes after this break with Dr. David McLaughlin, the CEO and founder of CURB Health.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. Good.
apples and pears, beef and skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, ant and deck, fish and chips, mum and dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com. Strawberries
and cream. A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back to the second part of today's show with Dr. David McLaughlin, CEO and co-founder of Curb Health. So just before the break, David, you're giving us a little bit of a kind of like the background and the origins of how you decided to focus on this problem. So how does Curb actually work? What do people do?
Sure. So with Curb, we have a lovely onboarding experience where we ask people a couple of questions about their current relationship with alcohol, and essentially their goal. Are they looking to reduce their drinking? Are they looking to quit altogether? Or are they already sober and they're just looking to celebrate their sobriety with other like-minded people? That onboarding process, we also ask people a couple of questions about their use of alcohol and what their kind of common triggers are. And that helps us to stratify people into different types of drinkers, different types of goals. It's based upon research by a chap called Professor David Nutt, who basically understood that people drink for different reasons. And so different strokes for different folks. We need to understand why people drink in order to understand how best to support them to reduce their drinking. Again, always moving towards that more personalized precision model. Once you're on the platform, we offer you a 31-day program, and it's a little bit like sitting opposite me in clinic. So I work at a really lovely private hospital in West London called the Priory Hospital. It's the original flagship Priory.
The original rehab.
The original rehab, yeah. And people pay a lot of money to sit opposite me for an hour in clinic. But what I wanted to do is offer as similar an experience as possible. But instead of having to pay several hundred pounds an hour, people can access for this for an absolute fraction of the price. And essentially, every single day, you get a video lesson. And it's a consultant addiction psychiatrist talking to camera as if you're opposite me in clinic. Mm-hmm. But accompanying each of those daily lessons, we offer you an interactive exercise. Again, based upon everything's research-based, based upon science, on what was been proven to be effective. So we use cognitive behavioral therapy. It's one of the most well-established types of therapy that people might be familiar with in anxiety, depression, but we've adapted it to apply this to addiction services. Then after, so essentially you're doing these interactive exercises, but you're actually building a portfolio of tools and information about yourself that will kind of you can use. It's a resource essentially that you're kind of curating over this 31-day program.
And what kind of CBT stuff? Can you give us an example? Give me just an example of one type of exercise. Just curious.
Of course. Okay. So if you imagine yourself in a situation, and so say the situation is. The way that CBT works, right, is all about the interaction between our thoughts, our feelings, and our behaviors.
Okay.
So imagine a situation where you're in a after work, and you have these thoughts in your head, and your thoughts are saying to you, if I don't have an alcoholic drink, everyone will think that I'm weird. I'm feeling really anxious, if I don't have a drink, that anxiety is going to get worse. Or I've worked really hard today. I've done really well. I've made my target, so I deserve a drink. Some of these thoughts lead to emotions, and those emotions lead to those unwanted behaviors. So with cognitive behavioral therapy, it's about recognizing those patterns of thoughts and seeing if we can adapt or change those patterns of thoughts upstream before the emotions, before the behaviors, and identifying specific kind of types of thoughts. So in addiction, we often talk about permissive thoughts. So an example of a permissive thought might be, I deserve this, or everybody else is having one, or, you know, like, I've just heard,
like, give you like the kind of give yourself a break, it's not the end of the world type thought.
Exactly. But that's what, in addiction, we call that a cognitive distortion, because it's not necessarily always based on reality. It's sometimes, because addiction actually changes the way that you think and you perceive the world around you. That's why, you know, you have these people that they know they've got liver cirrhosis, but they're still drinking really heavily. And it's because it's not because on a rational level they don't know that the drinking is slowly killing them. But if you were to explore their thoughts, they've probably got these distortions. You know,
my grandma's the same. She was a bit of a drinker, but she was a lot of a smoker. And she had emphysema and just cracked on with the fags, you know, and everyone was like, Grand, you don't want to like knock this on the head, you know? And then, but yeah, like similar type of thing.
Yeah, and it's what a lot of us do with addictions or harmful habits. And it's because of a concept called cognitive dissonance. When there's this kind of misalignment with our behaviors and our values and our kind of cognitive thoughts, we have to, in order to marry up that kind of that dissonance, we have to do almost like psychological gymnastics to allow ourselves to still carry on with these behaviors. But what cognitive behavioral therapy does in this context is it unpicks the psychological gymnastics, and it helps you to think in ways which will make you feel in ways that reduce the likelihood of you drinking in the first place.
And the whole ethos, and that this is a genuine question, not a leading question, this is around helping people to reduce their alcohol intake, as opposed to, you know, anti-alcohol conceptually, or sort of like, I don't know, like did I get the ethos right? It's about reduction. It's not necessarily labeling anything or stigmatizing anything or that type of thing.
Yeah, you're totally right. So we deliberately went with the name Curb, because Curb means different things to different people. And what I wanted to do was open up the front door, grease the front door to make this as accessible as possible. Because actually a lot of the time people don't want to go to services like AA or, you know, come and see me in the
prior. I mean, AA is a big step, I suspect. It's a big step.
And it's fantastic when people feel ready to do that, but not everybody does feel ready to do that. And any reduction of drinking is good for your health, because there's there's no amount of alcohol that is good for you.
In so the same way, there's no amount of asbestos that is good for you.
That's it. Is exactly that. However, what people will notice on our platform is we ask you if you want to quit altogether, and if people do want to quit, if they're ready to quit altogether, we will work with you towards that goal, and we'll celebrate all of those milestones with you. So we have the other function as well that we offer is a daily pledge and review. So we create a sense of accountability for people who might not be able to get that accountability from other places in their lives, or might not feel ready to get that accountability. And then the other thing that we do, because we talked about community earlier, we have a quite an active online community where people can kind of connect kind of openly or anonymously with other people who are also in that journey to curbing their alcohol, whether that's reducing or quitting altogether, and sharing as much or as little as they want to.
Right. We're going to dig into this community aspect in the last part of the show, because I think that it's really interesting. And I want to really try and get under the skin, if we can, around like these different tribes or groups that exist or coexist. Because like from the outside looking in, like AA, for example, is an abstinence-based approach, I believe.
Yes.
You're the expert. Yep. And that isn't necessarily, by the sounds of it, exactly where you are, although you do facilitate abstinence if people want to do that. And I think it's just a really interesting approach to have those things in a community coexisting, which I think is really healthy because it speaks to this like continuum, you know? And anyway, so we'll be right back after this short break with the last part of today's show with Dr. David McLaughlin, the CEO and co-founder of Curb.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Optimizing your health and well-being is on your to-do list? Then let Revive Active, Ireland's number one super supplement brand, help you achieve that in the most convenient and comprehensive way possible. Clean, premium ingredients scientifically formulated to work in synergy to support immunity, energy, joints, heart health, sleep, emotional balance, and more. Benefit from the power, purity and positivity of our award-winning powder sachets or our therapeutic capsule range. Use code RADIO15 at reviveactive.com and save 15% off today. Super supplements for a super you.
Cappuccino, latte, Americano, flat white, macchiato.
Just imagine, for less than the price of a single cup of coffee out on the high street, you could enjoy an award-winning online magazine every month with up-to-the-minute information on health and healthy lifestyle. Sounds like a good trade-off? Check out Health Triangle magazine on the UKHealthRadio.com website. Just sacrifice a single cup of coffee every month.
Let's all put health first.
The station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back to the last part of today's show with my guest, Dr. David McLaughlin, the CEO and co-founder of Curb Health. So let's talk about this community. So was this always in your product vision, or did it sort of evolve? And how important do you think it is?
So it wasn't always in our vision, or it wasn't always in the product. However, like any kind of entrepreneur or any product owner, you have to listen to your users. It's so critical, so important to do that user discovery, really listen to people, like engage with them, speak to them. And what we experimented with different things like WhatsApp groups. And we also did a pilot study, really, really successful. Actually, we published this pilot study in the British Journal of Psychiatry Open and presented it at the Royal College of Psychiatry's International Congress. This is where we first showed, that this product was safe, it was effective, that we were improving clinically validated depression.
What endpoints? What were the results, like give or take, roughly? Like what did it show?
So roughly 92% of our users managed to curb their drinking, reducing
92%. It's quite high.
It's good, yeah.
92%. It's pretty good.
Yeah. It was really good, and we had a small sample size, but we still showed statistically significant improvements in mood and anxiety. It was honestly like a real eureka moment for me. It was like that was what kept me going during some of those difficult days where I just thought, oh my gosh, why on earth am I doing this? Like, why have I taken on this problem? When we were kind of doing some qualitative research afterwards, and again speaking to all of these pilot participants, and I was saying, oh, why is it that it worked? What was it you liked about the product? You know, was it our breathing exercises?
Yeah, did you love the CBT videos?
Yeah. What was it? Do you know what they were saying to me? They were saying, we just like the weekly check-ins with the other pilot participants and that sense of community, the sense of that everybody was doing this together. So then that was when we're like, okay, we need to make a community feature on the product, because it's that kind of positive peer pressure, positive role modeling. That's the kind of stuff that's you can't replace that. You've got to, and actually one of the things with, I mean, I love technology, I love innovation, I love like machine learning, AI, but one of the things I've always wanted to do is actually use that technology to leverage our human support networks, because actually there's still there's still a real value in human connection. But if we can leverage, if we can use machine learning to leverage that type of support at the right time to the right person, that's the real value.
So I think there's this really, and maybe there's some research on this and I've not found it, but I think it's a bit of an interesting philosophical question, which is, I'm sure probably by now, if not already, you can create AI bots that basically mimic community, if you like, give or take. And if you can't now, you probably soon will be able to. But I, even if those bots said the same things that people were saying in your community, as soon as you find out that's not real, the value of that thing just goes, I think, from a human perspective. But yeah. I don't know how to like make that objective, but that's how I feel.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're probably right. It's about the sincerity, like the author.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's, I mean, I am really curious about like the use of AI avatars and kind of AI agents. But I think it's really difficult to replace real, especially when it's peer support, because the value of peer support is that it's somebody who's like you. And I think there's a role for AI chatbots, but maybe to, as a kind of distraction tool, or maybe to kind of share information, or
like, if you're feeling like this, have you read this? Have you, you know, like, have you seen this video, which is about that thing that you're worried about, sort of concept?
So again, it's all about kind of thinking about what the problem is and what is the solution. What does the solution need to do? So if the problem is that people feel lonely, they don't feel that sense of connection, I don't know if a chatbot will be able to replace that. But if it's about kind of, I don't know where to find this information, I need a person to signpost me. Well, actually, that's the kind of thing that a chatbot could do just as well, if not better.
And so with the community, is it anonymous or not anonymous, or optionally anonymous, or how does it get run?
It's totally optional. So we've got people posting who are totally anonymous, and then we've got other people that will post selfies and show pictures going for a run in the park, kind of like Instagram, but for people who are curbing their relationship with alcohol. And we try and make it uplifting and celebratory. But actually, the majority of people on our community, they don't post. It's interesting, but they still get value from watching other people on that journey. And when we look at our user behavior, the community is one of the most popular parts of the platform.
Yeah, I mean, I know for myself, like over the last kind of, I guess, 3 years, I would say I've always taken, you know, 3 to 6 months off alcohol, probably, you know, give or take. And it's very helpful to be able to talk to people about what you're doing. Because, you know, it's you know, like the, you know, one of my triggers, for want of a better word, is like when the sun's out.
Yeah.
It's a classic, right? Like, beer garden thing, you know, and having people to talk to that are doing a similar thing to you helps massively in those instances where they're like something, I don't, you'll know the neurological process, whatever, but in my head, it's like a little flick. It's like, oh, sun's out. Ooh, kind of thing.
Yeah. Know? Yeah, definitely. It's a trigger. It's a conditioned stimuli. You've learned to associate one thing with the other, and then you kind of go down that path. But I mean, that's the other thing actually I'd love to do with the community at some point, is to stratify that community according to people's drinking goals, so that you have people that are aiming for sobriety that are only with other people who are aiming for sobriety.
Because that must be a little difficult sometimes, right? Or not, I don't know.
It could be, but what we find with the community is it's universally supportive. And there's a sense of respect that all of the community members have for each other. And it's generally about people looking for advice or sharing their own tips for kind of drinking less or not drinking. So it's funny, it hasn't been disruptive at all, actually, even though people will have different goals.
Well, everyone has the same goal, right? In effect, which is I'm guessing no one joins the community to drink more, one would hope. You know, it's like everyone's kind of like there to drink less or not drink at all.
Yeah.
Alcohol, you know, so sort of it's the continuum thing again, but it's all sort of trending on the same arc.
That's it. And the other thing actually is I have a hypothesis. I mean, this is what I've seen with my patients in clinic. Often people will see me in clinic and they'll say, okay, Dr. David, I just want to drink in a healthy way. Like, and I'm saying that with like brackets. Yeah. Out there. I want to control or moderate my drinking. And what I always try and do in my clinic is just to engage people. Just, do you know what, whatever way they want to start that conversation, I'm here for it, because just having that conversation is a good thing. But then, you know, we might try and support them with drinking in moderation initially. We might try and, you know, avoid these situations where they get done for drink driving, or they get into an argument, or they get in trouble with the police, or kind of like overspending, something bad happens. And you know, I'll be there to support them with harm reduction, drinking in moderation, mindful drinking. But often they'll come to their own conclusion that their life is better. Their life is actually richer just without alcohol. But it's more effective if we allow the person to come to that conclusion themselves, because people believe what they hear themselves say. It's part one of the principles of motivational interviewing. So actually, what we do with Curb Health and with our platform is actually really quite similar to what I try and do in my clinics. Just, it's all about engaging people and getting, you know, kind of making sure they stay with us, and then they'll come to the right conclusion themselves. You know,
you can't force people to do things, you know, and particularly, again, I'm not obviously an expert in this area, but from my own personal experiences and, you know, generally being aware of addiction conceptually, like, it strikes me as even more impossible to get people to, you know, give up something they're addicted to. You can't force them to do that, because personal willpower has to come from yourself.
That's it. You can't, I mean, there's that expression, you can lead the horse to water, but you can't make it drink. They've got to be ready to change. But what we can do, though, is, you know, engage them, get them using the platform, show them, like other people in the community, that role modeling, those kind of, other ways of living.
I think that there's a real value there, actually, because I remember the, you know, like, it's all well and good doing Dry January, right? But everyone's doing Dry January. So, well, not everyone, but a large number of people. So it's sort of, everyone's kind of in it together. But actually, there is that fear of like, well, all my mates go to the pub, or what am I going to do? Or, you know, will no one talk to me? Or, you know, am I going to go out and things like that? And so actually being able to see people living these rich lives without alcohol, and, or not even rich, just normal. Like, it doesn't change. It's just your life just without alcohol. I think it must be really powerfully supportive for people.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, that's the thing. I just love it when we get emails or get positive reviews from people on apps or Google Play Store, people emailing us, just, you know, telling us kind of the impact that it's had. That's, again, what makes it all worthwhile. It's a nice industry to work in.
Yeah, for sure. And like, what's the reaction been from the industry, whatever that industry is? Like, what is the industry? Addiction industry? What is it?
Yeah, I guess it is. I mean, there's private addiction services, NHS addiction services. Overwhelmingly, it's been really positive. People are really curious about what we're doing. You know, most people who work in this industry they're mission focused.
Yeah.
So we're all aligned with the outcome that we want. And I found kind of various clinics and providers just to be really, really curious. They're keen to collaborate. I mean, that's one thing that we're always really open to, is collaborators for research. We've already won £200,000 worth of Innovate UK grants.
Congrats.
We're applying grants in the future. So we're always really curious and keen to kind of speak to clinical providers, collaborators. And again, we're mission focused. And actually, the moment, what we've done is we've actually removed the paywall, because we just want to get as many people on the platform as possible, and encouraging as many people to download it for free.
I mean, what do you think the stats are in the UK of people that have an unhealthy relationship with alcohol? Like on that continuum. So there might be a healthy slide. You could argue there's never a healthy. Anyway, what do you think as a percentage in the UK, in effect, should be using your app for a very good reason?
Okay, so I would say that anybody that drinks alcohol in the UK would benefit from drinking less.
That's a great statement. That's a great statement.
It's like saying if you smoke, you know, right, who should smoke less?
I think that's such a mentality shift, right? Particularly for the Brits, right? It's like no one says there's a healthy level of smoking anymore.
No. And so actually, I mean, so the chief medical officer, the government's chief medical officer, has said that healthy limits, you know, or the recommended guidelines is not to drink more than 14 units of alcohol per week.
So like that's seven alcoholic drinks, like seven pints.
Exactly. Well, less than that, actually.
Probably, is it?
More, wow. A lot of beers will have maybe like 5% in them. So actually, it's probably more like even like just five or six beers per week. So that's what the government's chief medical officer said. No more than 14 units of alcohol per week, but approximately 25%. So one in four adults drink more than that. So one in four of us are exceeding.
I'm surprised it's that low. I think that lowballs it, to be honest with you.
Well, if you go into certain sectors of bankers, lawyers, people who've got work in kind of heavy manual industries, those figures are much, much higher. So again, if you're somebody that lives in if you live in a big city, that's where it's normalized and all of your friends around you drink heavily, then that would be much higher. But so it works out as about 10 million adults in the UK are drinking at harmful levels, and then there's about 600,000 adults in the UK who are physiologically dependent on alcohol. That's people who are addicted, who
that
drink.
That is a lot of people.
Every single day. Yep.
Just not as a percentage necessarily, but just as a number. That's a lot of people.
Yeah, and these are the heaviest drinkers. These are the people who might get the shakes, who might kind of go into withdrawal. These people who are kind of working towards liver cirrhosis, and they're possibly still working, and still kind of functioning again with kind of, you know, inverted brackets there, because I mean, are they really functioning at their true potential if they needed a glass of wine at lunchtime to get through the day, or even a glass of wine at breakfast to stop the shakes? But it's about 10 million adults in the UK are drinking at harmful levels, and then over 500,000 are daily dependent heavy drinkers.
On that note, we have reached the end of the show, but I think it's a good opportunity on that. It's like, if people want to find out more about Curb, where do they go? How can they access it? What do they do?
The easiest thing to do is just check out our website. So it's www.curb.health. That's where you can download the app on App Store, Google Play Store. That's where you can play with some of the cool tools we've got there. We've got like a employee cost calculator, so businesses can figure out how much hangovers cost their organization every year. You can learn more about kind of how the platform works and all the different features that we have there. But the easiest way is just to go to www.curb.health. I'm always really happy to chat to other founders, people who've got personal stories, experience with alcohol, people who want to partner with us. We're actually not fundraising currently, but again, always open to kind of conversations with investors as well. I think it's just always good to kind of keep the conversation open.
Agreed. Well, look, David, thank you so much for coming on the show. And thanks to everyone for listening. We'll be back again next week with another show.